Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Thank you so much for coming on this day when there's a tube strike and there was a fire alarm. So we just thought nobody was going to continue to have the patience to stay. So we're really grateful that you're making it here, as well as to our online audience who Martin will be attending to. I'm Swati Dhingra, I'm an Associate Professor at the Centre for Economic Performance in the Department of Economics, and I'm also an external member of the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England. So today we have this great event. I don't think we could come up with a more timely event, a book launch. And we're going to talk about how to win a trade war with, for those, how many of you actually know Charan Sumeya from their podcast? Oh, so there are a few fans in here and the rest are new people who you will be getting as fans soon. So just to say, in 2016, Chad and Sumeya launched Trade Talks, the podcast, which is one of the most authoritative places to get everything you need to know about trade, and not based on the rhetoric, but on actual academic work as well as more policy-focused research. So what we're going to talk about is their new book, How to Win a Trade War. And just to let you know, Chad has worked in a couple of White House administrations, both on the Council for Economic Advisors as well as as the chief economist of the Department of State. Sumeya, of course, is an FT journalist, and we have two excellent discussants where there's a bit of an embarrassment of riches. Martin Wolf, who's written several books on international trade, as well as is a well-known FT columnist, and Stephanie Rickard, who's a professor of political economy in the Department of Government and has just very recently chaired the World Trade Review's 25th anniversary at the World Trade Organization. So we're going to get lots of different people with lots of different opinions. And without any further delay, I think we should get straight into it.
Thank you, Swati. Everybody, you saw what she did there, though, right? She asked how many of you had heard of Sumeya and me, and then she said, you have fans, and those aren't the same thing. Right? Thank you for trying to make it seem as though that were the case. It is a huge, huge honor for Sumeya and I to be here tonight. These are some of our heroes up here on stage, so it's a bit, we're kind of fans ourselves, but we'll do our best. So the book is titled, How to Win a Trade War. And that is a title that for economists is quite awkward. As Swati mentioned, Sumeya and I started working together. The podcast, we probably tried to start it in 2016, but it really probably didn't get going until 2017 or so. But the roots of it really did start in 2016 with the arrival of a couple of things, Brexit obviously happening here, and the arrival of Donald Trump in the United States. And in that earlier era, when Sumeya and I were working together, when people would come to us and ask, how do you win a trade war? We would be the first ones to say, you don't fight a trade war, right? So if you were to ask me that today, should you fight a trade war? Probably, hopefully if you're taking economics here, you would say, no, you shouldn't fight a trade war. Trade wars are awful. And the challenge is, unfortunately, and why we try to explain that in this book, is that is no longer an option for us. Not fighting is no longer an option. We have to fight a trade war. And so what this book is about is how to do so, okay? Now, since I started in that place, and Sumeya will probably give a little bit of her story about how she transitioned to this new perspective as well, let me take a minute to kind of take you on my own personal journey of how I got there. So for me, and as part of this, we have to understand what trade war we're actually talking about, because when you read the headlines today, there are actually a lot of trade wars going on, right? President Donald Trump, you might have heard of, really likes tariffs, right? And he's out there fighting maybe a different trade war every day. And I think what we would argue, what we do argue in the book is, yes, that's a thing. And that's an important story to understand and provide context for what is actually going on in the world today. But at the same time, it's a bit of a distraction, because it's not actually the trade war that we should be fighting, that we need to be fighting, and that is happening out there, you know, sort of despite or alongside maybe what President Donald Trump is doing. And so what is that one? And that is China. It's the story about China. And so let me describe a little bit about what I mean by that. China even for those of us who were the biggest proponents, defenders of the international trading system, the WTO, I spent the first 20, 25 years of my career writing about multilateralism and the benefits of rules and a rules-based system, China was always a challenge. Its subsidies, its state-owned enterprises, its way of doing business was always going to be difficult and something that we would have to grapple with, and the existing trading system didn't grapple with very well. That was always out there sort of lurking in the background. But something else happened with China along the way, I think, in the last 6 to 8 years or so, which really changed my own personal views about why this trade war that we're fighting right now actually needs to be fought. And I think probably the most precise articulation of it was President Xi Jinping's dual circulation speech. I think this was around 2020 or so, when President Xi said explicitly kind of what had been lurking in the background for a while with some, you know, documents, some policies of the Chinese Communist Party, that his view of the world and the international trading system was that he envisioned a world in which the rest of the world, UK, Europe, the United States, Japan, the Western sort of market-oriented economies, would become dependent on China for their supply chains, or for the things that they needed to make their economies function, right? The inputs that they need to be able to make things happen. But China, on the other hand, was not going to be dependent on the rest of the world. Okay, let me say that again. He wanted the rest of the world to be dependent on China, but China not to be dependent on the rest of the world. When you step back and you think about that, and you think about what international trade fundamentally is all about, right? It's about a willingness to have interdependence with other countries. I will export to you, you will export to me, right? And sometimes we'll have frictions about that. But in general, that's what makes things work. If all of a sudden a major player out there in the system is going to say, nope, that's not how we view the world. I want you to be dependent on me, but I'm not going to be dependent on you. I'm going to not only have that as my philosophy, I'm going to implement policies to make that more and more likely to happen. Industrial policy, macroeconomic policies. And those policies are going to show up as outcomes in the real data over time. And then sometimes, which we've seen over the last year or so especially, I'm going to weaponize that. I'm going to take advantage of the fact that you're reliant on me for things that you need. And sometimes I'm going to either threaten to cut them off or actually going to cut them off and exert some pressure on you, to exert some pain on your economy when you're doing things that I don't like, whether it's in the economic sphere or increasingly in the military foreign policy security sphere as well. So for me, that was really the sign that we're in a new world now, and that the old rules no longer apply. We're in a trade war. This is a really uncomfortable position to be in, so we need to think about things differently. So let me conclude by telling maybe two other quick stories, and then I'll turn it over to Samantha. Swati mentioned my time in government. My first experience in government, I was in the White House in the Obama administration, and I was the senior economist for international trade. What that meant was I was the most important trade nerd in the White House. And I was there in 2010, 2011. And in March of 2011, you had the Fukushima disaster in Japan. Offshore earthquake, tsunami. Devastation for the Japanese economy, you know, tens of thousands of lives lost, potential nuclear disaster that the world was on pins and needles for months waiting to see what was going to happen with the nuclear reactor. A terrible tragedy all the way around. My job as the most important trade nerd in the White House was to write a memo to the president that afternoon. This was a Friday afternoon in March. Explain to the president what the impact on the U.S. economy, despite all the tragedy in Japan, what the impact on the U.S. economy was likely to be of this tragedy through supply chains, right? Again, at this moment in time, we're still, you know, a ways away from the financial crisis, but unemployment was still hovering around 10%. The United States had bailed out its automobile sector. We now owned, right, General Motors at that point, the U.S. government did. We were petrified of another crisis for the automobile sector that might throw hundreds of thousands of Americans out of work, right? My job was to explain to the American president what the impact of Japanese supply chains being cut off from the United States might be on the American economy. It was the shortest memo I ever wrote. It was essentially, we don't know, right? We didn't have data. Back then, we didn't really know what supply chains were. So it was a really uncomfortable moment to be in that job. Fast forward, 15 years, maybe 10 years later, right? We have the pandemic. And all of a sudden, we've got product shortages, started out with toilet paper, personal protective equipment, chips, semiconductors, right? Suddenly, we couldn't get enough of those to make toasters or washing machines or cars, right? Governments, again, got really, really scared, worried about their vulnerabilities. Where was all this stuff coming from? Why were we having these product shortages? And what they did at that moment in time was they actually sunk money into trying to figure out where these things were coming from. So a lot of much more sophisticated, bringing in the nerds, data mapping, vulnerability assessment exercises. And so when I went back into government, as Swati mentioned, I was the chief economist at the State Department later on, that's a lot of what we were doing, trying to understand where our vulnerabilities were so that we could begin to tackle them. Many of our vulnerabilities, it turns out, not only in the United States, but we did this in cooperation with some partners here in the UK, across Europe, Japan, again, Korea. We learned that we were all very vulnerable to China. A lot of the things that we were sourcing were almost entirely coming from China. And that, again, sort of raised concerns. But last point is part of that data analytics exercise that we all went through. I think what we also learned is it's important not only to understand your vulnerabilities and where you might be attacked, but it's also important to potentially understand your strengths. So that if you are attacked, you know where it is that you can fight back. You know where it is that other countries are relying on you, so that even if you're having things weaponized against you, you can say, you could do that, right? But then there is this other thing that I could potentially take away from you, and maybe you shouldn't do that, right? Now, sometimes there weren't enough of those strengths there to be able to push back, and I think that's what we're now working through as well. Point of that story is 15, 16 years, a lot of improvements in terms of what nerds could do when it comes to data, role of artificial intelligence and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, there's still a lot of vulnerabilities out there that we don't know about. There's still a lot of worries out there in the world that we have to think about. And in this new world of economic warfare, you really need to best understand not only your weaknesses and your vulnerabilities, but also your potential strengths as well, and to build up those strengths. And to tell you about how to do all of those things, I'm going to turn it over to my co-author, who needs no introduction. And let me really conclude here by saying, working on this project with Samaya Keynes was absolutely amazing. We really, really hope you like the book. There's a lot of jokes in the book. If you find them funny, it's because of her. If you don't, you can blame me. With that, I'll turn it over to Samaya.
Hello everyone, and thank you so much for braving the tube strikes, the weather, and the locusts standing in your way. So I thought I would try to map out the structure of this book, because really what this book is a map, right? It's supposed to be the guide, what you need to know to understand this new world of economic conflict that we find ourselves in. And so the conceit of the book is that you, the reader, come to us, two trade nerds, one tall, one short, and ask, I really want to fight a trade war. I'm desperate to do it. And we sort of, look at each other, we're not that excited about our task, but reluctantly we say, well, this is the world that we're in. We have to accept where we are. And so if you're going to engage in this world of economic conflict, which not doing is an option, then at least let us arm you with the evidence, history, the economics. Because ultimately, if you want to engage in this world, if you want to win a trade war, you're going to have to massively expand your definition of winning. Because fundamentally, Trade wars aren't going to make anyone richer, particularly. So winning might just mean minimizing your losses, right? Winning might mean doing as best as you can possibly do in this difficult terrain. Now, before, in the old rules-based system, we could sort of switch off our brains and ask, okay, well, we could just follow the rules. The rules say what we can do and what we can't. But when those rules aren't working anymore, we have to switch our brains back on. We have to acknowledge that the other players in this fight are playing dirty, and we may have to reach for tools that are really, really hard to use, that have all sorts of horrible unintended consequences. And we have to learn how to minimize the unintended consequences of those. And in some cases, in narrow cases, in targeted cases, working with allies, we may have to use them. So you come to us looking a bit bemused by that monologue. And then we set out what you need to know. So we set out the stakes in a trade war, peace and prosperity. We introduce you to the players, governments, companies, people. We explain why the old rules didn't work, why you might have to fight a trade war, both from the macro perspective, thinking about global imbalances, but then also the micro perspective, really talking about the challenges that Chad was discussing, which is that in some cases there are over-dependencies in the international, in the global economy, which are being weaponized. And in those cases, you do have to act to protect yourself against that weaponization. The next three chapters look at that defense. So identifying your vulnerabilities, in which Chad takes a star turn, in the White House, in the Situation Room after Fukushima. And then we talk about subsidies, how to subsidize. Because when you've identified a vulnerability, you do need to do something about it. Or if you want to encourage a strength, then you might need to use subsidies. Then we talk about stockpiling. So I spent many happy hours reading the Reddit Preppers Forum. Exploring why maybe we should laugh a little bit less at the preppers and do a little bit more listening and take them seriously. We should learn about stockpiling and prepping from the people who have done it for a long time and learn from their mistakes in some cases. So having done that, then we talk about the attack, right? We talk about tariffs, we talk about export restrictions. And that's, you may have noticed, is an awfully long way before we get to the juicy bits. Right, before we get to the tariffs and the export restrictions that people associate with trade wars. And there is a message in that, right, which is to draw the parallel between trade wars and real wars. So in a real war, you can't just run onto the battlefield with a big gun and hope for the best. Logistics win real wars. You have to do the prep. You have to build up that defense. Be strategic, do the planning, coordinate with allies. And trade wars are no different. And so, it is going to take you quite a long time before you're ready to use these awful tools, tariffs and export restrictions, that are so difficult to wield, that have all these unintended consequences, which are the reasons we've been so reluctant to use them in the past. In a conclusion, we try to look forward, to think about scenarios of what could come in the future. In the final scenario, I kill off Chad, because I want to be the star of the show. He's cool with it, he's totally cool with it. I guess I worry that, you know, there is a scenario in which things have to get a lot worse before they get better. And maybe our version of winning is, you know, if we avoid World War III, maybe we all deserve a pat on the back. That's great. And maybe that does sound a bit pessimistic. But I also don't want to be, you know, starry-eyed and leading you into it, you know, giving you a false sense of security. I don't think that there is a grand trade deal around the corner where we can all kind of hug it out and make friends. I think the 20th century, it took a conflict. There were decades of trade tensions, and then ultimately it took World War II before, you know, a group of allies decided that actually they wanted to do something more cooperative when it came to trade. I really, really hope that that's not where we're going. And I'm optimistic enough to think that we can avoid it. But for now, where we are, we need to be thinking about this manual, be thinking about what we can do. Because just saying no one wins a trade war isn't enough. I'm going to tell two. I'm going to put out two things from the book now. There's a lot in there. If you read the book, which I encourage you all to do, you will note that there are many, many analogies. some would say that some are tortured analogies, and I couldn't possibly comment. But in one of the chapters, in the chapter about the players as governments, the analogy is with the trading system as choppy seas, increasingly choppy seas, and each government is a boat on that tense battleground. So you've got the Americans. They used to think of themselves as the noble navy fleet, patrolling the seas, enforcing the rules. How lovely. Now they've revealed themselves to be pirates. So I didn't actually think of this particular bit of the analogy myself. It was suggested to me. And the person who did so suggested that I watch the film The Pirates of the Caribbean. And to watch the scene where Keira Knightley, or the character she plays, goes to the chief pirate and say, oh, but the pirate code says you must do this. That's my best Keira Knightley image. And the chief pirate says back, well, number one, you're not a pirate. And number two, it's less of a code and more of a guideline. And that's really the way you need to think about the Trump administration's approach to trade policy making right now. And in particular, the rules. So you've got the Trump administration, they're the pirate ship. You've got the Chinese, they're a warship, right? They've got their cannons pointed out, not necessarily firing all the time, but unfortunately, they're not looking very friendly right now. You've got Europeans, they're a slow merchant ship. They haven't got any guns, they're very distressed by all the weaponry being pointed around. And they just want to sell stuff. They're very annoyed that they can't get on with the business of selling stuff. There's a little boat next door, which we call the Awkward Drifter. That's us. And you know, when I say I talk to the analogy, there are many more boats. We do apologise in the book for the number. So there are boats. It's fun. Great. But there is a serious argument in this chapter as well. And as we run through the boats, we're explaining the incentives of all these boats. So let's just take the UK. We want to get cheap stuff from China. It's great. We want cheap solar panels, we want cheap electric vehicles, we want cheap items to help with our green transition, which is an incredibly important policy objective. At the same time, we want to stay close to the Americans because we do rely on them to make our nuclear deterrent work. They're quite important for security matters. We also quite like selling lots of services to them. We also want to stay close to the EU because they're big and they're rich and, oops about Brexit. And unfortunately, pleasing all of these three players at the same time isn't very easy. And so far, what we've tried to do is avoid choosing. Right? We don't want to join the Americans and put up tariffs against the Chinese. That would undermine our net zero goals. We want to be the free traders. We want cheap stuff because, of course, no one wins a trade war. And what we saw, and we're not the only ones who have these split incentives. So now let's just think back to what happened after Liberation Day, when Donald Trump applied his tariffs, right? He got so much stick. Why are you applying tariffs on everyone? Why aren't you focusing on the real problem at hand, which is China and its the impact of its excesses on the global economy? Why aren't you focusing on them rather than hitting everyone with tariffs? You're shooting at everyone, you're hurting your allies, you're making them trust you less, and that is making it harder to tackle the fundamental problem. It's what the standard criticism wants, and, fair enough. But if you spoke to members of the Trump administration, then you would understand that actually they were incredibly frustrated by their allies. Cooperate with allies is all very well, but those allies were a nightmare to cooperate with because of all these split incentives. So if you look at the UK, even Europe, right, we're looking to the US to maybe solve that problem of China. The Americans are the ones who have to apply the big stick, make prices go up for their population. The Europeans, the Brits, we don't want to do that. We quite like the Americans to do that, that'd be nice. But we're going to stay out of it. We don't want to choose. We're not going to get our hands dirty. And you can see that collective action failure as well when it comes to China. Now, if you want to, there are suggestions, there are murmurings, rumblings in Europe that maybe they will take action to defend against some of the kind of manufacturing wave coming from their model. And it's very, very hard to get consensus within Europe because, the Chinese can retaliate. Also, they can offer investment, they can withdraw that. So you've got these kind of challenges of collective action. So the same challenges that happened after the Trump administration applied to tariffs, when, you know, Trump's trading partners could have joined up and said, no, we'll negotiate as a block. You can't pick us off threatening tariffs to do these individual deals. We're going to negotiate together. There were signs of that. They went nowhere because the allies just couldn't coordinate. And that's the same dynamic as you see with China. So the point of that chapter was, one, to make this bigger point, right? The collective action is really, really hard. And secondly, to reframe some of that criticism. The Trump administration got so much stick for failing to cooperate with allies. But actually, maybe some of the heat should have been on those allies for failing to coordinate and act when it came to a shared problem, a shared challenge. Okay, so that's to say that there are lots of jokes, it's all very fun, but there are some serious messages in there as well. Okay, so that's that chapter. So I'm going to skip towards the penultimate full chapter, which is the one looking at export restrictions. And so this one starts, and this one I want to give a shout out for John Minnick, who works here at the LSE. He's done some really excellent research on this that we drew from, and also the historian Daniel Hydro. So towards the end of the 19th century, we were the dominant ones. The Brits had enormous power over international communications. So our companies were dominant. We effectively controlled these vast networks of telegraph cables. They snaked along the seafloor, connecting countries around the world and powering communications. Now, the fact that our companies effectively controlled these meant that the government could surveil and censor other governments' communications. And the Brits had that power, and they used it. During the Boer War, they censored and surveilled other European governments' communications, and those other governments were not happy about it at all. The Germans, in particular, very, very miffed. And they responded. They said, okay, well, you've got power, you're abusing it, we're going to respond. We're going to build our own network. We're going to build our own network of telegraph cables, and we're going to try to turn to innovation. We can see wireless radio, which could bypass the need for these pesky cables. So maybe we can escape you that way. And you can see the parallels today, right? So just think about the dominances in the global economy that are being weaponized. You've got China with its rare earths, right? China's restricted access of its rare earths to other countries. And effectively what they've done is they've taught the US and other governments that they need to protect themselves from that Chinese weaponization. Similarly, you've got the Americans and their allies. They are restricting access to their technology in making chips that go into AI. The Americans are perfectly capable of weaponizing their dominance when it suits them. And what that's done is it's taught the Chinese that they need to build their own alternative technology. They need to protect themselves. And so you've got this idea that these export restrictions are a one-shot weapon. You can fire them once, but by restricting something that a trading partner needs, all you're doing is teaching that trading partner that they need to build resilience, build protection. And so the power of your weapon diminishes over time. So the end of the story with the telegraph cables is that the Germans didn't do it. It took decades to unseat the dominance of the Brits. And it wasn't the Germans that managed it. It was the Americans that became the next dominant power in international communications. And the reasons, first of all, were that, one, the Brits, there was a reason the Brits were so dominant in the first place, right? They had huge technological advantage, they had a head start, it was a massive feat of engineering to construct these huge networks of telegraph cables. So the very factors that created that dominance in the first place were the same factors that made it so hard to escape that dominance, right? If you wanted to build your own network, that was just very, very difficult. And similarly today, it's not at all trivial for Western allies to build their alternative mine-to-magnet supply chains so they don't have to rely on China anymore. It's not at all straightforward for the Chinese to build their alternative semiconductor manufacturing supply chains. These technologies have been built for years, and it's taken decades to build them. There are huge barriers to entry. So it's not as straightforward as, they can just wriggle out of reach. And the second reason that it's not as simple as, these are one-shot weapons, is that, yes, the weaponizer can move, and then the victim or the target can move. But then the weaponizer can move back. They can move again. And so what happened with the telegraph cables is that the Germans tried to build their alternative network, and that involved laying cables that landed on other countries' shores. And they needed permission from other countries' governments. And when they went to ask for it, those other governments said, oh, we're a bit worried about the Brits. When the Germans went to the British government and said, please will you give us permission to land our cables on these other countries' shores, the Brits said no. And so you have this, this is a dynamic game. There are more moves than you might like. And so what you're seeing today is, again, you're seeing the Chinese restrict access to, they're restricting the movement of their people. Western governments are trying to create these alternative supply chains, and the Chinese are blocking the export of the people with the right expertise to be able to create those alternative supply chains. They're blocking the export of technologies. The Chinese are moving to protect their dominant position. In semiconductors, the US is, well, the Trump administration is doing the same thing, but they have been reacting to concerns about circumvention, about the export controls not being particularly watertight. So this is a dynamic game. And unfortunately, the lesson here, how you win a trade war, is that you've got to make a lot of effort. Because this thing, these dominant positions, they could last for a really long time. You could have these chokeholds, these weaponized positions. Now, if you want to try to eradicate them, to lessen them, you've got to turn to all of the tools that we talk about in the book. These terrible tools, subsidies, stockpiling, tariffs in some cases. But don't expect any of it to be easy, because as we explain, history, economic research, our own reporting, speaking to over 100 officials and other experts around the world, suggests that this is not a case of running onto the battlefield and shouting hooray. This is going to be a slog. So stage one, realize you're in a trade war and you have to engage. And stage two is, eat some energy bars, because you're gonna need a lot of it. Thank you. All right.
Interpretive dance part.
So it's a great pleasure to be here, and great honor as always. I think the last time I was here was the debate on my own book on a vastly cheerier subject, namely the death of democracy. So this, by comparison, is really fun. So what do I want to say about this book in about 10 minutes, 5 minutes? Well, first of all, it is, I think, genuinely, I haven't read every book on trade or every book on economics by any means, but I don't think a book written like this has ever appeared before, at least I'm unaware of it. It is incredibly lively. Its authors are absolutely determined to be witty on about every other page. It has more metaphors, analogies, and similes than you can possibly imagine, and most of them you would never imagine. And I have to say that is impressive and unique, because it is unique to one of the co-authors, who is my colleague. And the result is a mixture of brilliant, fascinating, and infuriating all together. And that sort of a personal reaction, and all of you will react to it differently. And I recommend strongly reading it, because you will never read, might well read more books like this in future, because the authors are still around, but you will never have, I think, read a book like this. I was thinking while I read it what my own teachers on international trade back in the Middle Ages when I studied international trade at Oxford would have thought of this book. I was taught by somebody called Max Corden. Some of you here, the old people here, might have known who he was. He was a very distinguished international trade economist, contemporary of the great trade economist at the LSE at that time, Harry Johnston. You all know who he is, of course. And what would they think of this book? They would be stunned. So that's important. They've broken, I think, ground in the way we write. And they have done this very much in giving you a how-to book for fighting a trade war, why you're in it, and how you should do it. This focus, in my view, leaves a few quite important issues to one side, and I will just discuss a few of those, things that matter to me. And I have to start off by saying, partly because I was taught by people like this, and partly because I was taught at a time when the 1930s was still very much in our minds, if you studied trade policy. The 1930s were not a great period for trade policy, by the way, and the main villain was the Yanks, so my willingness to accept the US as always the good people is limited. Anyway, in the 1930s, from the 1930s, my generation of economists learned trade wars are not just a bit fun, and they're certainly not just a bit damaging, they're catastrophic. So that I still carry around with me. And to me, the book doesn't really convey this at all. So that's an important point. But let's go to things that I think are important. And there are three things I want to just, four things I want to comment on very, very quickly. The first is, why do we have this trade war? Why are we seeing this behavior now? And I think it would not be unfair to say, Chad gave at the beginning, the answer that is sort of in there, is, because it's obvious what's made this a global trade war, is that America has reacted immensely powerfully to China. It's about the bilateral relationship between the US and China, and it's the trade war we see now is a reaction to what the US considers to have been China's trade war on it. And I think that is a very big part of the story as seen from both sides. But there is another way to look at this story, which I think the reader should have in mind. One, the Chinese have been moderately bad boys too. Don't deny this for a moment, but it is the most successful development story in the history of the world, and for those like me who worked on economic development and think that was important, that was a pretty big thing, and not to be poo-pooed. And the second point is, of course, why did China's trade hurt the US as it was so much? Well, I think the big answer to that is because changes were occurring in the US economy, which were very adverse for a very significant part of the working class, and trade policy of China is unquestionably not the main reason for that. I suggest you read Paul Krugman's Substacks and other such writing on that. But what trade wars are about is what I consider the great principle of trade policy when it's bad, which is blame foreigners first. And that element in this story, I would like to see more emphasized. The second point I wanted to make, which is I think almost completely in here, is who really loses in trade wars? It's a complicated question, but basically, in the sort of trade war we're seeing now, the sort of trade war we see in the 30s, there are losers are small, poor countries. And they don't appear in this book at all. They're just I may have missed a few paragraphs on it. There's one sentence on the simply outrageous victimization of Laos, which first the United States bombed to smithereens in the Vietnam War, and now it's attacked, or recently attacked, I don't know where the tariffs are now, with the most offensive tariffs ever. Why? Because of the most ridiculous formula in the history of trade policy, designed to justify tariffs on the basis of the ratio of the trades balance, bilateral trade balance of the country in question and the US over its trade with the US. And this may came to the conclusion, if I remember correctly, that Laos and Swaziland were quite particularly vicious. So the result of this sort of trade policy, I'm giving that as an example, is complete craziness which victimizes very weak, poor countries. And that really matters. So who loses really matters. When you start a war, I don't think it's a very good thing to bomb all the completely innocent bystanders. And I would have liked more rage about this. I think, I'll just focus on one last query, a question which I think where we need more elaboration. There's a very interesting, very short chapter on what next, really short. In other words, how do we escape from the trade war we are now seeing? And I wanted to have a discussion of the possibility that the parties concerned, particularly the US, but possibly China, might realize fairly soon that this is mutually destructive behavior. And that actually a deal would be rather a good thing. And it might not take 50 years to get there. It might actually be sooner than that. And the reason I'm a little bit optimistic about this, but only a little bit, is that one of the great things Donald Trump has done, which is linked to what I just said earlier, is to take the craziness of a trade war to way beyond any conceivable logical limits. And it looks so absurd, and the results are so ridiculous, and it has led to humiliating climb down vis-a-vis China, that's what I'm seeing at the moment, and so much bad relations, so much in the way of bad relations with the rest of the world, and it is not going to restore American manufacturing, it is not going to restore the industrial working class to the status, the state that they think it should be in, and it's not going to make America more secure. So maybe the optimistic view which I want in this chapter next time is, this is seriously stupid. We now can see it's seriously stupid. Let's have a sensible deal between the US and China and forget the idea that trade wars are necessary or sensible. We're just going to stop. Thank you.
I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Martin, that's a hard act to follow, but I'll try my best. Chad and Sve, it's wonderful to have you back at the LSE. Welcome and thank you for coming, and congratulations on this excellent book. I really encourage all of you to read it. It is informative and entertaining and everything that you want a book to be. So I really appreciate the approach they take to the book. And for those of you that have been my students, you'll know that I take a similar approach. And it's a really useful way into the trade war. It's a useful way into any difficult economic or political question. And that's first and foremost to identify the actors. Who are the key actors here? And second, to think about, what do they want? What are their incentives? And that's really the approach that they take in this book. And so it's a great way in. It's a really engaging way in. And it helps us think through, in a systematic way, something that's extraordinarily complicated and sometimes looks irrational. So they identify three key actors, or the three players: the government, companies, and people. So I want to talk first about people. Second, I'm going to talk about subsidies, a subject near and dear to my heart. And third, I want to talk about the conclusion, looking forward, and what we might see in the future. So first, one of the key players they identify are people. That's a broad category. We can think about people in a lot of different ways. Let me give you two. First, we can think about people as consumers. We're all consumers. We buy goods and services for our own use, for our own entertainment and joy. So what do we want as consumers? We want the option, at least, of buying low-cost goods or competitively priced goods. We also want a diversity of goods. We don't just want to be able to buy one type of car or one type of tennis shoes. We want a diversity of goods. So those are our interests as consumers. What does that mean for a trade war? It means consumers hate trade wars. Consumers, when they're facing or living in a country that's engaged in a trade war, it's very likely that they'll see higher prices and less opportunities to buy diverse goods. We know that in trade wars, there's often a ratcheting up of tariffs. You raise your tariff, I raise my tariff, we get into this tit-for-tat strategy. And as a result, the cost, the tax that's imposed on goods coming into the country is higher. And we know that much of that tax is often passed on to consumers. So now as a consumer, stuck in a trade war, I'm paying more for the products I want to consume. Second, I may also have less opportunities. One of the outcomes of this trade war has been uncertainty. We don't know when we're sending our goods into a country, if I'm a business owner trying to sell my goods in a country, I don't know what tariff I'm going to face by the time my boat gets there and offloads the goods. Will I face 25%, 5%, 10%? That kind of uncertainty potentially will deter goods from getting into the country, meaning as a consumer, I have less options available to me. So my interests as a consumer really are to end the trade war, stop the trade war, stop, make it stop. And so a question to Chad and Sumay is, can't a savvy politician, a savvy government, mobilize consumers to help win a trade war? And if not, why not? So one way we can think about people is as consumers. Another way we can think about people, though, is as voters. Now, of course, this is not relevant for all of the countries engaging in trade wars, but it's relevant in some of the key players engaging in trade wars. What do voters want when it comes to trade policy and trade wars? Do voters like it? Will they vote for politicians that start a trade war, that fight a trade war? Or do they hate it? Are they going to potentially vote against them and punish incumbents and governments that start trade wars and fight trade wars and lose trade wars? And so there's a good discussion in the book about what do voters want. And there's a lot of research on this. A lot of people go out and ask voters, what do you want about trade? But you could probably guess, well, you're here at the LSE, so maybe you couldn't guess, but you might be able to guess the modal response, the typical response. I don't know. What are you talking about? What are you asking? What's a tariff? Most people, when you ask them about trade, don't have a well-formed opinion. So we have a lot of research on how people might respond to a survey about trade, but it's really hard to know how those responses then translate into their vote. When you go to cast your ballot, are you actually ever thinking about trade? Are you voting for or against a party or a politician because of trade? Maybe, but probably not. And so I think we need a lot more research there. And so this is maybe not your job, so maybe you can encourage us to do more research on this. Maybe it could be your job in your next book, of thinking about how voters actually reward or punish governments for starting trade wars. I should say, to be fair, we do have a little bit of evidence that trade and trade wars or trade matters in particular parts of the world, in particular parts of the country. In the United Kingdom, for example, some parts of the country were much more exposed to rising imports than other parts of the country. And we know that those parts of the country that were exposed to more imports and greater rising imports are precisely where we see the highest votes progressing. So there may be some effect of trade on voting behavior, but we need to know more. We really need to understand what the interests and incentives our voters are when it comes to a trade war. Okay, so that's people. Number two, subsidies. Again, I'm so glad to see a chapter on subsidies. This is a really important topic. And again, we just need to know more. We don't have good evidence on how subsidies work. We don't know if they can actually help us win a trade war, but I absolutely agree with Chairman Sumaya's suggestion to governments, which is to start small. Right? Maybe start with small subsidies first and see how those go and give us some evidence. Do they work? Do they not work? Before you ratchet up to the big guns. So I think that's a really good strategy. But a question that I wanted to pose to Chairman Sumaya and maybe to have some discussion with you as well is, subsidies work differently now. They're different today because of who benefits from them. Who gets subsidies? Big multinational corporations. Right? It used to be the case that the British government used British taxpayer money to support British firms. Think about the Leyland Motor Company in the 1970s and 80s. But that's not how it works today. Today, the British government uses British taxpayer money to support firms that are owned in India or Saudi. Even China. So we have a good example right now where the British government is spending £369 million subsidizing Tata Group, an Indian-owned firm that's building an EV battery plant in the United Kingdom. Now that's interesting politically, but economically I wonder if it means that subsidies could actually be a way to engender international cooperation. Maybe they don't solve a trade war, but maybe they bring different countries together. In the example I just gave you with the UK giving this big subsidy to the Tata Group, it did seem to help, even though Tata is not government-owned, it's a private company, but it's very close to the Indian government. It seemed to help as a symbolic measure of the cooperation between the UK and this Indian-owned firm, and potentially it helped move forward some of the discussions in the UK negotiations with India in their bilateral trade. So maybe subsidies could be a solution rather than a problem. So my third and final point is on looking forward and thinking about where do we go. And I agree with the authors in that they say we're looking at really a fractured world. We're looking at more and more sort of blocks and a fractured trading community, and I think that's right, we already see it. But what's curious is that here, when we think about the fractured community and we think about these big boats and the UK is the little boat, we see the groups as the US, the EU, and China. That's how I think we see it here. And the UK is this little boat trying to figure out how to navigate these big tankers. But in your world, in your sort of conclusion, you think there are three different groups. One cluster you have, the US, the UK, and Europe in group one, working together. Then you have China, and then you have India. So that's a very different model of the world. And so I'd love to hear more about how you think the UK, the US, and Europe come together, coalesce, and cooperate as a combined bloc in this trading world going forward. Thank you.
Martin suggested that, you know, that maybe the underplay how bad trade wars could be. There is a whole chapter on trade leading to actual wars, which I think we all agree is fairly bad. But this is interesting because the time we were writing this, you know, we got the book deal at the end of April of last year, right? So the month of Liberation Day, and you know, there had been, I think, a fair amount of catastrophizing about the effect of President Trump's tariffs. You know, markets were not happy at all. And, you know, in the end, he did row back on you know, the most extreme measures. upward pressure on US prices, but there was a pretty significant increase in US tariffs, and we didn't see the kind of really, really bad economic fallout that I think some of the commentators were warning about when the tariffs were first mentioned. And similarly, the Brexit, right? There was lots of very, very dire warnings about the potential effects of the Brexit vote. And in the end, I'm not saying it was good, but the immediate, the short-term hit wasn't quite as bad as some of the more alarmist accounts were predicting. I think where we ended up on that was that often, outside of the catastrophic escalation that ends in a hot war, if you're just dealing with tariffs and tit-for-tat, actually, the effects can be, it's very damaging, but those effects can be quite slow to show up, right? It's really the long-term drag from the lost innovation, the lost productivity, from the kind of the protection from that competition, which is a kind of healthy force, hopefully, in most cases. And so for kind of smaller trade wars, for modest trade wars, I think it's important not to be too alarmist about their effects, because otherwise, there would be people reading the book and thinking, well, hang on, the US economy is, it's not amazing, it could be better, but it hasn't completely collapsed. What we do try to do is sort of set out the extreme scenarios, because arguably, in our lifetimes, we just haven't experienced the kinds of catastrophic trade wars that really were the risk and what was experienced in the earlier part of the 20th century. So that was an interesting point. I think the point that smaller poorer countries have already mentioned is a fair criticism. It's actually one of my kind of regrets that we didn't have more and partly I'm going to blame economists for that. I think a lot of the research on tariffs, there's a lot of stuff on the impact of tariffs on, say, the US economy. A lot of evidence comes from Brexit. There are some examples. For example, looking at poorer countries applying export restrictions on food and how that can backfire. It was hard, but I'm not excusing it. I think with more time and more pages, that's an area that we can improve for. On the what next and how do we escape, and maybe we shouldn't have been quite so pessimistic. Maybe we should have envisioned a deal closer on the horizon. Some kind of grand bargain between the US and China, because they realise that trade wars are self-defeating. We tried really hard. Chad came up with some pretty spicy ideas that I...
She killed them.
Yeah.
They were really bad.
They were really bad. One of them involved a big warehouse where China would send all its stuff to.
It's huge.
Huge warehouse. And we would decide who would get the stuff. Sorry, Chad. But genuinely, so thinking about what that kind of grand bargain could look like, I think the challenge is that there is a structural problem. Compatibility almost between China's economic system and almost political system and this rules-based order, right? At a basic level, what we tried to do is write a system of rules that would restrain subsidies, would kind of set the rules of engagement to an extent. And one of the challenges in China's system is you can't see the subsidies often. They're in the water. They're just kind of there. It's not like the government is writing a check and then publishing how much money it's giving to Boeing or Airbus or whatever. And so really what you want to do is solve the structural problem, right? You want to say, okay, well, if the challenge is subsidies, then let's write rules that constrain the subsidies, and that means that we can all work together. And I think what we couldn't do is come up with a set of constraints on those subsidies that the Chinese government would accept. Arguably, the Trump administration did try to get the Chinese to change their system. But imagine if the Chinese came to us and said, "Hey, we want you to change your economic model, which is deeply related to your political model." We wouldn't be able to do that. We'd say no, right? And so you know, having spent a long time saying, let's do a deal, let's try to solve these structural problems, I'm pessimistic because I don't see a path forward for that. Now, if you don't think that, you know, perfect trade deal is going to happen, then you're left with sort of managed trade, where, you know, we will agree to buy and sell stuff from each other. That's very ugly, uncomfortable, and maybe gets you a warehouse. And it's maybe something closer to what the Trump administration has been trying to agree, right? You know, setting numeric targets on some agricultural products. But that isn't really a way to manage the whole trading relationship, and is extremely cumbersome. So I really, really want that to be some kind of deal. We did actually write what we think a deal in the shorter term would look like when we did this. We wrote a column for the New York Times, and it was a sort of anti-trade deal. So what we were doing was we were sort of recognizing that there are these over-dependencies, and in those areas, all bets are off, right? And so really what the risk is now is that in the race to reduce over-dependencies, governments go too far. They get confused. They say, we want to reduce our over-dependencies on rare earths, but their protectionist interests come in, and all of a sudden we've got tariffs on everything and everyone, right? You really want to avoid that. And so this idea for some kind of deal or some kind of organization would be some sort of independent process to identify those areas where actually we do think there is a problem because there's just too much concentration of supply. And in those areas that organization would identify, all bets are off. You don't have to follow the rules because there's no dependency. It's unrealistic to think that anyone's going to be following the rules when you've got that chokehold just sitting there. You know, the Chinese aren't going to be open traders when it comes to chips. They want to build resilience. We're not going to be open traders when it comes to rare earths. We want to escape Chinese. So maybe the best you could do is some kind of trade deal that restricts, that kind of sets guardrails or boundaries on the areas in which the rules are going to be completely broken and disregarded because governments are going to be engaging in that race to reduce their dependencies on each other. And that limits the risk of a broader tit-for-tat escalation that could ultimately end in military conflict. That's as optimistic as I could get.
So let's leave it at that level of pessimism and we'll open it up to the audience. Yes, well, the person at the back there, and then the person in the middle, so number one, number two, and the lady at the back there, number three.
Constraints on national defence and the need to rearm. In from the British perspective, is a unitary welfare state compatible with a trade war?
We'll just take two more and then connect it up.
Okay, thank you very much for addressing the conversation. My question is the last year China between surplus for like $3 billion. And if you look at it across continents, it seems despite declining trade with the US, seems to be expanding across Asia and Africa. So there's some conflict right now with the EU, but if the trend continues, then we see China taking a greater share of trade with
And your question is?
And my question is, where does that leave us in terms of the other countries? Is there a possible trade war between, say, China and countries Africa or Latin America, other than just the US?
So I think the third person with their hand down, so maybe we should start with these two questions and the person at the back there, the lady at the back. Yeah. And we'll have one more and then I think Martin wanted to come in as well.
Thank you. I'm just wanted to ask, are trade wars, are they all driven by economics or by domestic policies?
Great. So please feel free to take whichever ones. The main ones are welfare state, is it compatible with a trade war? What about when China starts to get into trade wars with Asia, Africa, Latin America? And the third one, is this all about economics or about domestic politics?
Yeah. Welfare state is a great question. I think one of the challenges right now is the trade war that has to be fought, right? The one that we're arguing for. Is going to require some costs, right? This is not free to diversify, to create alternative supply chains outside of China for the things that we're excessively dependent on. And the challenge really is an affordability crisis that UK, Europe, United States, lots of countries are facing right now, which is you don't want to fight a trade war on everything that isn't necessary because that raises prices to consumers when you really actually do need to impose some costs on them here, right? So if you want to sustain any sort of welfare state and do the other things, you have to fight the trade war as effectively and as minimalistly, that's not a word, but I'm making it up, as you possibly can, or else you're not going to be able to do it at all because society's going to push back. I think that's the first thing that I would say. I have to address one of Martin's points. I'm sorry about this. It made me so happy when he said the book infuriated him, right? But I need to explain why. This book was incredibly uncomfortable for Samantha and I to write, right? I too was trained in the same, I know Max Corbin, I've read all his work. Swati and I had the same graduate school advisor who was constantly on my shoulder as we were working on this project, challenging me on everything. Samantha and I fought incessantly about things in this book. This is really, really uncomfortable stuff, and we can't deny that, right? So, to wrap this up, when we did a podcast with Paul Krugman last week, right? And we asked Paul, Paul, you won a Nobel Prize. Part of the reason why you got a Nobel Prize, you won the Nobel Prize, was explaining the benefits of international trade that comes through agglomeration economies, right? This has been a massive field in economics for 30 or 40 years now, right? This is why countries trade, take advantage of economies of scale. But hasn't this led us to this situation right now, where we have these massive concentration of production of certain things, which in a new world where countries don't like to be interdependent with one another can be weaponized? Didn't you all think about that when you were winning Nobel Prizes? And we didn't ask him like that, but he said, no, this was a very different world back then, right? So, yes, this is not orthodox, right? But it largely reflects, unfortunately, the new world in which we have now.
I just wanted to make a comment on, which isn't really an empirical question. It's not as ideological as that was. But it seems to me, the more, and when Samaya explained it, and sort of reminded me of it, this is really about a trade war between the US and China. And that's what they're concerned about. And there are two things that are very interesting, which tell you that's what this is about, and I'll just come very quickly about what it means to the rest of us. The most striking difference, and Samaya mentioned the famous literature of the 30s, and the people whom I mentioned who wrote about retaliation cycles in the 50s and 60s, what would happen if you started protection, is that essentially no one has followed the US. Basically, I will leave this out, China is sui generis because it does things actually say in a slightly different way. But most people in countries in the world, including ourselves, still follow our MFN tariffs. The WTO as an institution doesn't work, but the agreements that were reached among almost all countries in the world in the WTO and GATT and the US still operate. Nobody's changed it. They don't think this is a very bright thing to do, because mostly they think that they will be hurt by getting involved in it. So it's a one-sided war. And there's a second side of that, which is, since China has been very clever about the way it's fighting it, unlike the US, and that's a very important part of the book, it follows from what's being said here, nobody wants a war with China, including Europeans, including the Brits. Yes, we are worried about some things. We're a bit concerned about motor vehicles and so forth. Are we going to exclude all Chinese motor vehicles and silicon and telephone and the rest of it from the European market? I'm prepared to bet a great deal we're not. So I think this is essentially a war being fought by the US on China with lots of collateral damage in the rest of the world, which nobody else wants to follow. That's not saying it's trivial, it's very significant, but it is important, just that's why I was checking my phone. Approximately 65% of world trade does not involve either the US or China. And if the rest of the world decides it doesn't want to get involved in this because it's stupid, and the rest of the world decides that it doesn't really want a serious war with China either, because that's dangerous on multiple dimensions. And the US decides to go rogue for all sorts of reasons, which I don't fully understand. Then it's not as significant, in my view. We're not in quite as catastrophic a world as some may have suggested. And this is basically talking about, I mean, very, very wicked in the way I present it, because I don't really, but we're basically talking about a pathological breakdown of the US political system.
The domestic politics question.
But can I? So I think there's a really interesting change happening in Europe, though, right now. And you've seen it. You know, you've seen it with the Industrial Accelerator Act. I don't think this is just about the U.S. and China. I think Europe is slowly, because it is that slow merchant ship that just really wants everything to go back to selling things. But it is moving towards the U.S. position. I don't think this is. You know, you've seen the. The Europeans worry about their industrial base. They're worried about the competition from China in third markets and also in Europe. The Europeans are never going to do a big ban like President Trump is, but they are headed in the direction of taking defensive measures, which means tariffs, trade barriers. They've already done minimum pricing for Chinese electric vehicles. This isn't a bilateral fight. The Europeans are there too. And at some point, we're going to be asked, if they do erect trade barriers, the UK is going to be asked, where do you want that wall to be? Do we want to go with the Europeans or not?
So those of you who are European bureaucrats, you should close your eyes in some parts of the books, because the book does call them slow and pompous. But I think we should have one more round of questions. So let me actually go at the top there. The first person, number three row, and out there, the person with their hand up very high, and also the person at the back there.
Hi, cheers for the book. I would like to ask you about the common border adjustment mechanisms on the European Union, whether they should be used in trade war, whether CBAM and carbon adjustment should stay out of the trade war, because it's as offline as well. Saving our
question.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was the person there. And can we get the mic over to the person there in the third? Oh, sorry.
My question is for Chairman Somaya. How do you think your advice on how to win trade war changes with the political parties in power at our present time?
Hey, congratulations on this conference. My question is, what do you see as the most likely inflection point scenario that would cause the trade war to escalate into a negative conflict?
What's the most likely inflection point that will cause trade wars to escalate?
Could you just take one more out there? Sorry, we missed one person in the middle.
US government officials and Chinese government officials to perhaps come to an agreement that, stopping the trade wars and working in mutual benefit is more beneficial than, fighting private trade wars, specifically when it comes to technology.
We got that. Great, thanks. So, CBAM and let me just
four narrow questions, easily run through. Very good questions. So should CBAM be used in a trade war? I think I am, home-based user, and I do think you should try and make the instrument match the target. And decarbonisation is a worthy goal, and I'm not sure that you should be sneaking in your trade war instruments by claim that they're helping the green transition. I think that separately, I think a lot of, around the world, governments are looking for ways diversify away from China, but not make it obvious that they're discriminating against China. So you are actually seeing lots of governments use environmental regulations that mysteriously only China doesn't meet to try to force companies to source from other places. I don't love that. The Chinese can obviously see what's happening. I prefer things to be transparent. And as goes that, like, you know, the inflection point with respect to military conflict, I mean, I don't know, but there are lots of things that keep me up at night. There's an interesting bit in the stockpiling chapter when I was reading the testimony. There was a China, I'm not sure the exact name, but China Committee Senate hearing where the experts are being quizzed on, you know, what you saw, what were the signs of a conflict, and they were drawing from history and showing that yes, you know, the Japanese, I think also the Nazis, started stockpiling in earnest in anticipation of a military conflict. So that's one of the signs. And the risk is obviously that you start stockpiling, your partner or another country sees that, starts and misinterprets that as you preparing for war. Right? There's huge possibilities here for misinterpretation and escalation to the worst possible outcome. I feel like I've spoken a lot. Do anyone else want to jump in?
Martin wants to come in.
There's one point which I think I was thinking of talking about, but it isn't much made in the book, but it fits directly with what Sumaya said about European response, and it's a sort of classic part of the literature which doesn't appear anywhere else, which is home market bias. And the problem with import substitution, which is the policy we will probably follow with the EU's tariffs, and it's what the US is definitely doing with tariffs, is that it works if a necessary condition for its working. This is too crude, but at least a simple way of saying it is you've got a big enough home market to create and exploit economies of scale that are relevant, the agglomeration thing. And the problem by now for Europe, I'll just take this to European, we are worried about our home market, our domestic base, and the most important domestic base for core Europe is the motor vehicle industry. And the problem they have is that China has far and away the biggest demand for motor vehicles in the world. And if you look at electric vehicles, basically Europe, the US, and European markets together are less than half the Chinese market. So tariffs are just a hopeless instrument. And the only way you can deal with this is subsidized production for the whole world. That gets seriously expensive. And this links with your export subsidy, the subsidy point. The home market bias problem becomes really big if you're small. And Europe isn't that big. So that as a matter of pursuing some of these strategies, the trade war has to be modified by thinking about actually what you need to do to become competitive internationally. This is discussed in the book, but I think it's a much bigger problem than they indicate, and I think that will make Trump's tariffs almost completely unsuccessful.
If Europe is small, the UK is small.
Oh,
okay. We really have
the UK doesn't have the slightest chance in these industries, we should get them.
I totally agree. I want to respond to the politics question and very briefly the China question. It is deeply political. It is absolute. Politics is a huge part of the story, but it's not partisan. So remember, Trump won, came in and put in tariffs. Biden didn't take them off. He didn't reverse them. He converted them into voters, but he didn't come to office and say, oh, let's liberalize. Three different administrations in the United States have refused to appoint judges to the World Trade Organization's final court. So it's absolutely political, but it's not partisan. So don't think, oh, when Trump leaves office, everything will be fine. That is simply not the case. On the China, common ground, I think was the question, is there a common ground that we might see we can work together? On certain issues, maybe. We see examples of this. The UK and China are starting to talk about thinking about financial services agreements. China has a lot of savings. The UK has a lot of regulation and infrastructure and finance. So maybe on a case-by-case basis, but it doesn't look like that's going to solve the trade war.
Anybody
have
the AI question? That's right. I think we can have very quick, short questions, please. You've had your hand up before as well, so definitely you. And the person on the side there have been a bit remiss in getting that side. If we have. Sorry, actually, just a moment, please.
We can take a couple of quick questions from online.
We're going to go to the online audience.
One consistent question coming from people online this evening has been whether we need to reassess rules around loading trains to try and protect against tariffs and trade war protectionism. And another one is for Chapman Simeos to see whether or not you think there's any indication of anyone winning the trade war that's being served.
Perfect. So if you'll be patient, we'll try and get that, and if there's still time, we'll come back. But my guess is we're not going to find time, so please do stay back and ask the questions if you get the books.
Do we need to rethink the rules? I think the rules have already been rethought. I think, you know, as Martin said, obviously the rules are still underpinning lots and lots of trade in lots and lots of countries, so they haven't been completely abandoned. But the reality was that under the old system, the US is really doing the heavy lifting in terms of actually enforcing the rules. And I don't see the remaining players kind of trying to enforce the remaining rules with the same level of energy as the Americans. Not as many rules to be meaningful, they need to be enforced. Is anyone winning the trade war? Well, right now, the Trump administration is afraid to do anything too mean to China without, you know, the Chinese retaliating. So the Chinese seem to have the upper hand. If you define winning as, you know, you can do what you want, or you can, you know, escape, you can persuade or a trading partner not to hit you as hard as they want to. Then perhaps China's doing quite well there. Again, we take winning very, very broadly. So, you know, there are many, many possible options, but it's hard to see how the US is massively winning right now.
Okay, just jump in on that one. So, and, right, I would say that China is also winning in the sense that we, the West, the United States, but probably also increasingly Europe, are more and more adopting the Chinese model. In terms of doing subsidies, industrial policy, in the United States, we now own companies, but without really thinking about it, right? And so that's part of what we're trying to argue for in this book, is like, let's stop and think about this and see how much of our system we really need to adapt to be able to fight this trade war more effectively. Let's not just become the Chinese model, because it's not gonna work. There are some things that we can learn from China, one of which, and this goes to one of Stephanie's points earlier, China subsidizes, but when we as economists are evaluating the effectiveness of subsidies, typically what we do is we ask the question, do they make companies more productive, more profitable? And the answer is always no. That's not China's objectives, right? When they're giving subsidies. When China gives subsidies, it's can they buy market share? And the answer then is often yes. So their companies, their system rewards something else. We have to recognize that. And as we're approaching this, as researchers, as scholars, as policymakers, to better understand what China is actually doing out there and have that influence our own response and reaction.
Perfect. So let me stop there in terms of, we'll be offline in a minute, and thank you all for coming. If you are willing to stay a couple more minutes, as you do know, Sumaya is an accomplished musician and will be regaling us with a slight performance about the book. And also to say, for those of us who are trade economists, we're going to spend now the rest of our lives thinking more about where we went wrong and convincing various governments not to have trade wars. But thank you all for coming, and if you are willing to still stay back, we'll have a very quick pause.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.